really simple to me. It was just a good coho run. Both north and south of us had a lot of cohos. Why wouldn't the Yukon have a good coho run?
A record run of coho on the Yukon River. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Labor Day, Monday, September 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Chignik celebrates big fuel savings with hydropower.
I've noticed that I do have more time on my hands. It's not as much maintenance. Don't have to worry about it. There's many things going wrong with this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The new University of Alaska president has a contract that includes a yearly performance bonus of up to $75,000. Jim Johnson was hired in July with a five-year contract at an annual salary of $325,000. A bonus package proposal includes benchmarks for increasing alumni donations, boosting the number of Alaska Native graduates, and cutting administrative costs. That's among the nine goals that would contribute to his bonus. If all targets improve by 10%, Johnson receives the maximum $75,000. The Board of Regents has until September 30th to approve the bonus plan. Johnson replaces Pat Gamble, who retired after 5 years. This year's harvest of coho salmon on the Yukon River is the largest on record, with more than 117,000 fish caught. That's almost twice as much as Fish and Game's preseason projection. The record-breaking harvest comes out of a run that managers do not know much about, including how many fish are returning to their spawning grounds. From KIYU in Galena, Tim Bodoni reports.
The coho run is something of a mystery on the Yukon. It happens at the same time as the much larger fall chum run, and it's the least measured of the four major salmon runs on the Yukon. Managers only have one coho escapement goal for one tributary in the entire Yukon River drainage, the Delta Clearwater River. Fish and Game also conducts aerial surveys for coho in the Nenana River drainage and Upper Tanana River area, but relatively few coho are seen, and the numbers vary widely from year to year. Coho can also run quite late in the fall. Fish and Game estimates that about 20% of the run on average comes in after assessment tools like the pilot station sonar and the lower river test fisheries have stopped for the year. So the big question is, how big actually is the Yukon coho run, out of which commercial fishermen took a big bite this year? Jack Schulteis is the general manager of the major fish buyer on the lower Yukon, Quipuc Fisheries, based in Amonok. He faults Fish and Game for underestimating the true size of the coho run this year, and says that a big commercial harvest is a reflection of a strong run.
It's really simple to me. It was just a good coho run. Norton Sound had a good coho run, a really good coho run. Both north and south of us had a lot of cohos. Why wouldn't the Yukon have a good coho run? I mean, they're all out in the same ocean. They all came from the same parent year.
Schulteis is also critical of Fish and Game for reducing commercial fishing near the mouth of the river in mid-August, when he says fish passage was strong. The pilot station sonar, the main tool used by managers to calculate upriver escapement, was regularly showing that lower river fishermen were catching more fish than were allowed to pass upriver. Jeff Estenson, Yukon River in-season manager for the Department of Fish and Game, confirms that he canceled one commercial opener in mid-August out of concern that lower river commercial fishermen were catching too many coho. Upon further review, he concedes that the pilot station sonar has probably been undercounting coho.
After talking with the sonar staff, we kind of came to the determination that the number that we were reporting at pilot, the actual number was a little bit higher than that. So, you know, what we've been telling people is that, you know, for example, the 97,500 coho that we counted past pilot station sonar through the end of the operation, we believe that that's kind of a minimum count. And actually what we have going by was closer to probably the 122,000, which is about median or about average for coho past the sonar.
Estenson says that Fish and Game wants more information about where coho salmon go in the Yukon River drainage, with an eye towards setting more detailed escapement targets for the run.
And the department is pursuing funding right now to try to do a radial telemetry project on the Yukon. where the fish would, the coho salmon would be tagged in the lower river, and then we would use a series of towers and aerial flights to try to track where they're going, and then also try to get a handle on the timing of when they're coming in the river and as they're moving into different areas.
The escapement project at the Delta Clearwater doesn't happen until October. Even then, Estensen says, the data it produces does not show a strong correlation with the pilot station's sonar, leaving managers to guess on what the true coho escapement and run size might be. The Yukon Coho Management Plan allows Estensen to schedule directed commercial openings for coho in September, but he does not intend to do so, which would make Friday's openings in Yukon Districts 1 and 2 the last ones for the season. In Galena, this is Tim Bodoni.
Chignik Lagoon's hydroelectric project has been running since spring, but the village officially cut the ribbon last week. The system now provides 94% of the community's energy needs, saving the town about $500 a day on fuel costs. KDLG's Hannah Colton reports the village is readjusting to life with the cleaner, quieter power plant.
Packer Creek runs down a steep hill through the middle of Chignik Lagoon. Where before there were only small ATV trails, now there's a mile of gravel access road along the creek, leading up to a new dam. Walking along the creek to the ribbon cutting, Hydro Project Manager Michelle Anderson pointed out where the new road construction cut into the glacial till and the hillside.
This is all new road. At the bottom of that hill there, once we passed that gate, that fence, they started constructing. Yep. So this is all area that hasn't been opened up before.
Though the extra space is nice, it's low on Anderson's list of benefits to the project. The biggest advantage, she says, is getting away from diesel.
And just the fact that we have to haul diesel here, there's just that much more chance that we can spill or contaminate something.
The man perhaps most familiar with diesel in Chignik Lagoon is Larry McCormick, who operates the diesel plant and most of the other utilities in town.
I'm the garbage man, the guy that operates the sewer system, and also the fuel man. Yeah, pretty much everything.
McCormick has been working the diesel plant since it started decades ago, and now he and two other operators are learning to work with Hydro. At the top of Packer Creek, McCormick shows guests the 9-foot dam where water flows into a pipe through a metal screen.
When it first came online in March, the screens were freezing, and there was a couple of times where we actually had to bust the ice off of the screen.
McCormick says when ice or debris clog the screen, the hydro can shut off and the diesel will kick back in. Then it's his job to get the hydro running again. McCormick expects the year ahead will be full of these little challenges. Still, he says, the hydro will be much easier to manage than the old diesel plant.
If you ran a diesel engine for 1,000 hours, that's 4 oil changes, and that's 20 gallons of used oil that you have to deal with.
The used oil then has to be transported to a dump site and burned, says McCormick. The hydro system, on the other hand, requires just a little grease on the bearings every 1,000 hours.
I've noticed that I do have more time on my hands. It's not as much maintenance. Don't have to worry about it. As many things going wrong with this.
On the way back to town, McCormick gives a tour of the small hydro powerhouse. Inside, water flows from the pipe into a water turbine, generating up to 167 kilowatts of electricity. The generator is humming, but McCormick says it's nothing compared to the roar of the diesel plant.
Well, you wouldn't hear me if we're in a diesel plant right now. I'd have to be hollering and you'd have to wear earmuffs. It's really quiet.
For the 70 residents of Chignik Lagoon, this is what clean energy sounds like. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the growing pains of ballet.
Blisters and bunions and cuts and scrapes and calluses. And,
yeah.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Arvin Kangas of Tanana has been sentenced to 8 years in prison after being convicted of tampering with evidence following the deaths of two Alaska state troopers last year. 59-year-old Kangas was found guilty by a Nenana jury in April. He was charged with manipulating the bodies and guns of Sergeant Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabe Rich after they were shot and killed in Tanana on May 1, 2014. Kangas's son Nathaniel is charged with their deaths. His trial is scheduled to begin in November. Superior Court Judge Paul Lyle gave Kangas the maximum sentence allowed by law. Lyle said the tampering showed callous disregard for the troopers' bodies. Today is the final day of the Alaska State Fair. If you're looking to buy a 50-pound turkey or a 300-pound pig, the 4-H Junior Livestock Auction was the place to find one. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the bidding was lively on Saturday at the State Fair in Palmer.
25, 300 now 25, 325, 325, 325. That's the sound of a live auction at the Farm Exhibits Barn at the Alaska State Fair. Bidding was frenzied for the turkeys, especially for an all-white 50-pounder. More than 90 youngsters participated in the Junior Market Livestock Auction this year as sellers of animals that they had raised themselves. The 4-H program enables young people interested in agriculture to gain experience in both raising a quality animal and in selling it for a fair market price. Over in the corrals, Kyle Miley is patiently waiting with his pig, Jerry. Jerry, all 252 pounds of him, is lying on his stomach, seemingly oblivious to the hubbub around him. Miley's got a purple ribbon pinned to his belt.
Well, that was for showmanship, and showmanship is based off of how you show the animal. And so that was for showmanship, that's a participation award. For confirmation is the two blue ribbons, and confirmation is about the pig, how the pig looks. So he did better than I did.
Jerry's two blue ribbons were gained at livestock shows earlier in the fair. Miley says Jerry is most likely headed to the slaughterhouse depending on the winning bid.
It could be three bears, it could be Alaska Millen Feed. So it's usually a company that wants to, you know, just buy meat and sell it. So
4-H kids, some as young as 9, raise goats, lambs, turkeys, chickens, rabbits, and other animals for the program. When the animals are auctioned off, a small portion of the proceeds goes to support the program, but most of the cash goes back to the youngster who raised the animal for sale. Many of the participants borrowed money to buy and raise the animal, and they will pay back the loan with what they earn at the auction. Over in another stall, Temujin Horsey is hunkered down with his two pigs. One, Crazy Train, is living up to her name, while the other one snoozes peacefully at Horsey's feet.
This one I'm going to sell today, and he's an exotic breed, which means that you breed them so many different ways from so many different things that they're just a new color and a new everything.
The relaxed pig, contradictorily named Jolt, has got his share of championship ribbons too. Horsey has raised the pig from birth. Now it weighs over 300 pounds. I ask, will it be hard to let him go?
Yes, it is. I've been doing this. This is my fifth year now, so it's a little bit easier than normal, but yes, it is hard.
But it will be a while yet before the pigs are up for bid, and Jolt and Jerry are taking it easy. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Trans-Alaska Pipeline stars in a new film compilation that looks at the history of the 800-mile project through the experiences of five people who helped build it. The Consumer Energy Alliance partnered with the Alaska Support Industry Alliance to produce Pipeline Pioneers. The short series of profiles recently debuted in Anchorage. Sean Martini is the communications director for the Consumer Energy Alliance. He says the next stop for Pipeline Pioneers is Washington.
Showing it on the Hill to make sure that the policymakers in Washington, D.C. Capitol Hill staff and the legislators themselves understand the importance of these types of things as well.
Who's in the film? Who's featured?
So there's five members that are featured in the film, local folks here in Anchorage, all the way up to Point Barrow. Representative Ben Nagiak is in the film. Kathleen Dalton, whose husband is the namesake of the Dalton Highway. Scott Harder, a gentleman named Dave Haugen, and another gentleman named David Norton are all featured. All of them were present and involved in the original construction of the pipeline.
Do you look forward in the film to what's going to be happening with the pipeline? It's aging. There's concern about how much longer it'll be viable, both because of low flow issues and also just the age of the pipeline itself. Does the film look at what the future holds?
It does to a certain extent, and the idea is to present it as, you know, it's an important piece of infrastructure for this country, and it's going to continue to be for a while. You know, there's obviously things we can do to ensure that the age of the line is not a problem in terms of its ability to transport the oil from North Slope and offshore production. But also, like as you mentioned, throughput is an issue. We've got drilling happening as we speak, or at least getting close in the Chukchi. And we want to make sure that that continues to happen because Consumer Energy Alliance advocates for increased domestic production of all forms. For us, North Slope and Alaska energy production is critical to supplying that baseload energy supply to the broader mix for the nation as a whole.
Would you say that the main the purpose of the film is to help to ramp up support for offshore development and development that will keep the pipeline full? Is that the main idea, or is it a historical look predominantly?
It's mainly a historical look. I mean, for us, the importance is really just kind of communicating to people that this project is here, it's still here, and it's still extremely important to America. It's our largest working landmark, really. I mean, and one of the most important. You know, you have the Golden Gate Bridge, you've got a number of other landmarks, you've got the St. Louis Arch in America. You also have the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System that does an important job. And it being the 40th year from the start of construction, it was kind of important for us to highlight this type of thing. So it's a historical look, kind of a look at the members of the film, how the film changed their life, how it impacted them and the character of Alaska, what it continues to do to the country and the service it provides to the country today, and why that kind of thing is important. Because a lot of the times we forget about that type of thing. This is the one pipeline or one of the few pipelines in the country that you can see. It's above ground. People can kind of get a grasp for what it does. In the lower 48, that's all taking place below ground, and it's not sort of something that people focus on a whole lot. So it's a good way to kind of tie those themes in and make sure that folks understand that this kind of thing is important, even if you don't see it all the time.
Sean Martini is with the Consumer Energy Alliance. Links to pipeline pioneers are at our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek, it makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
There aren't any ballet stores in Southeast Alaska. That means it's hard for young ballerinas to find the right fitting shoes. So every summer, just before school starts, Philip Broadbent comes to towns across the region. He's a master point shoe fitter who served professional companies all over America. KFSK's Joe Sykes has more.
Where Philip Broadbent's from, boys aren't really meant to dance.
I come from working class North England. It was sissy thing to do. My dad was totally embarrassed about it.
But he hated school, and dancing was a way to escape the drudgery of life in 1970s England.
I was a terrible student academically at high school, going through normal teenage wasteland problems, and I thought, yay, this is a chance to get away from my hometown. and go to London and start a new life.
And he did, attending the Rembut Ballet School and working as a professional dancer for over 15 years. After quitting the profession, he moved to Spokane, Washington, married an American ballerina, and became an expert in fitting pointe shoes, which allow dancers to pirouette around on the tips of their toes. And Broadbent says for the young ballerinas waiting to see him in Petersburg,
it's a rite of passage.
A ballerina goes on pointe around her 13th birthday, when her feet are deemed ready to handle the pressures of pointe work. Lydia Martin is first up for a fitting.
How are you feeling about it?
Good.
A bit nervous or?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, mostly just excited because I've been working to get there.
For a long time.
Yeah.
But she's finally here and is waiting for Broadbent to work his magic. Although two of the older girls sitting beside Lydia have a few words of warning.
Is it painful? That's the real question.
Yeah.
It's like you get used to it. I mean, yeah. I'm used to it now. It doesn't hurt as much, but our feet kind of look gross.
Yeah. Blisters and bunions and cuts and scrapes and calluses.
Yeah.
It's so painful because it's not easy to go up on pointe. Standing on the end of your toes for long periods at a time is unnatural, and ballerinas are prone to suffering permanent damage to their feet, which makes it all the more important that the shoe fits. And that's where Philip Broadbent comes in.
Tell me about yourselves. Do I know you? Did I fit you?
You fit me before.
Here? Last
yes.
year?
Yeah.
Good.
I'm new.
No.
He gets to know the girls. He makes them feel comfortable. And Broadbent says what's important to understand is he isn't just some traveling shoe salesman.
I think choosing the right style of shoe and counseling the dancer about how to use that tool is what makes it an art form. What's that guy in Harry Potter who sells the magic wand?
Ollivanders.
Ollivanders, right, yeah. I can relate to it. I like to think it's romantic like that.
It might be romantic, but it's also hard work. As the older dancers practice on their points, Lydia works her way through shoes while Broadbent strives to find the perfect fit. Point shoes are hard and rigid. They have a nail in the center to hold them together. But for girls this age, sometimes Philip Broadbent has to take drastic action. He snaps the shoe and voila, it's a fit.
All right.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Lydia walks away happy. She's that little bit closer to being a fully formed ballerina. Although Philip Broadbent knows this is just the start for these young dancers.
Going on point is an exciting day, but it's the beginning of the rough road ahead.
But he says with his help, they're better prepared to make those first few painful steps in a pair of perfectly fitting point shoes. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Sykes.
The village of Nanwalik, on the south side of Kachemak Bay, recently held its annual Fun in the Sun Festival. For the kids, it's a weekend of swimming and fun, but for the adults, it's a way of teaching traditional values to the next generation. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
In the mountains outside Nanwalik, about 70 kids are splashing around the cool blue water of Second Lake. Salt and pepper-haired Rhoda Moonen is sitting on a beach towel, surrounded by haphazardly piled bags of kids' clothes and snacks.
Lots of memories, lots of beautiful memories coming up here and seeing all this fun, seeing the children being happy and laughing.
She's looking out over the lake, keeping a watchful eye on the children playing in the water and by the trees. Over by the woods, Tula is making sure her little sister Aurelia doesn't wander off too far. Tula escorted me on the several-mile trek up here, picking berries and explaining the plants and rivers and lakes we passed along the way.
We have to walk up lots of hills, and you go past Humpy Creek, which has a lot of fish in it.
Younger kids and older adults catch bumpy ATV and truck rides up to the lake. For elders, there's a special tea time.
They have the elders down in the village at the community hall playing games while the younger kids, they bring the kids up and they have them swim all day and they picnic. So it's really fun because we get to swim.
Tula's Uma, Pauline Demas, is sitting in her four-wheeler on the beach, also keeping an eye on everybody's children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
Yeah, it's just exciting. I mean, everybody's having just a wonderful day, and I don't know, it just makes me feel good.
Rhoda Moonen says that's one of the most special parts of this festival. It was started many years ago by an older couple who noticed that many of the kids in Nanwalek couldn't afford to pay for the snacks and games at the annual 4th of July celebration. So they promised that after that, there would be something special every year just for the kids. The food and activities would be free, and it would be by the community for the community. And now Moonen says the main event is the day-long lake swim and picnic.
I reminisce when I see children swimming here. I grew up with my parents here at the cabin.
She says when she was young, she and all her brothers and sisters would come up with their parents to go fishing. They spent hours exploring the forest and swimming. Her brothers used to spend all day in the water.
It was so neat. I mean, so beautiful back then. Today I'm 56, and when I come up here, I think about my mother and my dad a lot, and my family, and how much fun it used to be. I try to come up here every year and bring my grandchildren and let them feel the same, you know, effect I had when I was younger.
Times have changed in Nanwalek. Subsistence is still the core of most people's diets, but now there are stores across the bay, there's packaged food, there are outside influences that have brought hard times to the village. But along with that, there's resiliency and determination. There's a group of adults like the ones by the lake today that work tirelessly year after year to teach the next generations their values.
How to respect their land, respect their food, respect each other.
It's looking back to move forward in a positive way. Moonen and Demas both say these children are the future. And as they grow up, if they can remember days like this, where they're all working together, playing together, having fun in the sun, the future looks much brighter. In Nanwalek, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Bodoni and Galena, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, Joe Sykes in Petersburg, and Shady Grove Oliver in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
And by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.